Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
It was a year and a half in the making. It was wrapped up in about 5 minutes today. And so the logical next question is, what happens next in the trade war? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 15th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, in a way, honestly, it was kind of anticlimactic, the signing of the partial U.S.-China trade deal this morning. There was some speechifying, of course, about 5 minutes of actual signing and handshaking, and then it was done. 94 pages in all. China promises to buy $200 billion in U.S. goods and services over the next 2 years. The U.S. gets some market access over there and some technology transfer protections. The devil, of course, is in the details, and it has to be said here that almost all of President Trump's tariffs on Chinese imports stay. But it's a start, especially for American farmers who have been whacked the hardest by this trade war. We've gotten April Hemis on the phone. She is a fourth-generation corn and soybean farmer in Franklin County, Iowa. She is also the one, if you remember, who let me drive her combine when we were out there a couple of months ago. April, it's great to have you back on again.
Yeah, great to hear from you.
So were you watching this morning or were you out working?
No, it's cold and snowy and yucky in Iowa in January. So I was inside glued to the TV waiting for all of the big numbers.
And are you satisfied with the numbers as we know them so far?
Well, you know what? They threw out so many numbers that, you know, what I'm sticking with is the $40 billion that the Chinese vice minister said China would promise to buy, and that's the $40 billion.
Yep.
And then more if needed. So that's a huge jump from what we have been doing, even from 2017 when we were hitting records. Kind of where we're at.
Yeah, but wait, if they were hitting records before and now it's even more, do you think they can actually do it? Because that's the nut graph on this whole thing, right?
Yes, it is. None of us farmers are running out like the president said and buying tractors and buying more land. Let me just put that out there right now. Those were the record numbers in 2017, and we've gone way down from there since the tariffs have been put on. So it's going to be hard to regain that market share and then add on top of it. So I guess we're all optimistically hopeful for all this.
Okay, you know? I'll go with that.
And that's farming. So
right. Look, you go back and forth to China a lot. You do a lot of sort of client and customer management over there. Have you talked to anybody over there about this yet?
A little bit. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law actually live in China.
Oh.
So we talked about it. He was back over Christmas and, they're all looking forward to it. And what we forget in America is they need this deal just as much as we do. So, we tend to look past that, I think, but, that's the most we've talked about. And we didn't have any kind of specific numbers then, but, I think they're looking forward to some kind of a deal.
What's the buzz, at the place you and I had lunch? What's the name of that place?
Oh, Bradford Cafe.
Oh, the Stumble Inn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Number 2 Tenderloin in Iowa. And actually, I had with the coffee boys that you met, some of them.
Yes.
I said, okay, I'm going to be talking to Kai Rizdahl tomorrow. What do you guys think? And they all said, it was kind of, I hate to use the movie line, but show me the money.
Yeah.
And we're going into now where Brazil's crop is coming online, their soybean crop. So they traditionally, China moves and buys from Brazil now. Right. So what all of us are thinking is we really won't see an increase in prices until later in the year. And right. in fact, I just got my text message from my Cargill processing plant and soybeans are down 13.5 cents. So
market's going to do what the market's going to do, right?
Yeah. So it was kind of a, you know, okay.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll be back out there like when the weather's warmer. Springtime, maybe. Does that work for you?
Yeah, spring. Okay. Come and I just got another planter. So come and plant my corn for me.
That one. All right. April, we'll talk to you soon. See ya.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye. Thanks.
April Hem is there out in Iowa. We got her on Skype this afternoon. The details are finally out on this deal, but that does not mean there aren't still a bunch of questions, many of which came from you because we asked you to send them.
It's Brett Johnson from Los Angeles. What third-party country benefited the most while this saga played on? For example, where did China sign unexpected deals they may otherwise have had here?
It's a great question, right? Who picked up the business the United States has lost the past year or so? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has the answer.
So China didn't really need to sign a bunch of new trade deals. The country's businesses just sold their stuff elsewhere to make up for the drop in U.S. sales and bought more from other suppliers instead of the U.S. On the export side, Chinese companies sold more to Europe. Exports were up almost 10% in the U.K., and there was an even bigger increase in exports to other Asian countries. On the import side, the Asia-focused financial services group Nomura dug into this and pointed to the windfall that came to countries like Chile, Malaysia, and Argentina due to a surge in demand for the agricultural goods China used to buy from the U.S. The biggest winner, though, was Vietnam, which picked up business from companies shifting supply chains out of China to avoid those tariffs.
Kimberly Adams for us in Washington. More of your questions, her answers elsewhere in the program today. On Wall Street this Wednesday, mostly pleased, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The retail lesson of this Wednesday is, oh, what a difference a quarter makes. Target said today it expects sales for the current quarter, which includes this month and the holiday season, to miss the mark. Sales growth will be less than half of what the company expected. Pretty big letdown for a shop that had been stringing together a bunch of good quarters. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Target had been on a bit of a winning streak as it focused on boosting internet sales and remodeling stores. Charlie O'Shea with Moody's Analytics says the latest quarter is likely just a hiccup.
It's perfectly logical. It's explainable.
He says all those areas where Target has been doing well held up during the holiday, clothing, beauty supplies, private labels, but sales dropped in electronics where Target doesn't offer the deep discounts of some of its competitors.
They don't get into the sell a dollar for 99 cents game.
Even though Target has invested a lot in online sales, Doug Stevens with Retail Profit says it hasn't fully cracked the Amazon code.
It actually comes down to pretty simple math. The big winner in the holiday season this year was online.
Target also didn't sell as many toys as it expected. Retail consultant Bert Flickinger notes there weren't many big kids' movies in the months before the holiday, with the exception of Frozen 2.
So that suppressed sales of licensed products, both toys and apparel.
That's different from a year earlier when Target got a big boost in toy sales after the demise of Toys R Us. Flickinger says good results make people expect more good results.
Target's definitely a victim of its own success.
As to whether Target's disappointing quarter is indicative of a broader trend for the holiday season, we might get a clue when Walmart reports its earnings next month. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There was news this week from the financial services industry. Visa is buying the startup Plaid. Visa, you know, of course. Plaid, you probably don't, but Visa thinks it's worth more than $5 billion. Why? It's all about where consumers are headed in this increasingly mobile world. Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains.
If you've used a payment app like Venmo, you've used Plaid without realizing it. Mobile payments analyst James Wester of IDC says Plaid builds the digital plumbing that helps third-party mobile apps move money around.
Think about any of the financial services that you might want to access through a device. What Plaid does is allows those third parties to access the information they might need so they can connect with a bank.
1/4 of all U.S. bank account holders are connected to a mobile app through Plaid, according to the company. Tim Sloan, who tracks payments innovation at Mercator Advisory Group, says Visa is buying Plaid to expand beyond typical credit and debit card transactions, where it is the largest operator in the U.S.
In large part, this acquisition of Plaid by Visa is about them moving into adjacent markets. And they've been doing this for a while.
Visa bought Earthport for cheaper cross-border payments, Verify to improve fraud management, and the secure payments technology firm Payworks. In a call with investors, Visa CEO Al Kelly says he's positioning for a future where financial technologies, so-called fintech, fundamentally change the way we bank and shop.
As the fintech evolution and boom continues to take off, I think it's important for us to be more front and center on that.
For its part, the deal will allow Plaid to expand more quickly overseas, where it now has a foothold in only a few markets. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
With an eye toward the ever-busier news calendar, a quick reminder here. If you miss us on the air, might I recommend our podcast? We are available pretty much everywhere. Two things about trade wars. Number one, nobody wins. And number two, they don't just end. Here's another question.
It's Kevin Peasley in Salt Lake City, Utah. My question is, did the trade war have significant long-term impact on global supply chains? I'm curious if businesses have permanently shifted manufacturing locations, changed suppliers, or altered how they operate. Thanks.
Here's Kimberly.
Companies have definitely changed the way they do business around the world because of the trade war. The supply chain management firm Kima had a recent report out showing that there was a 14% drop in U.S. companies sourcing goods from China, working instead with China's neighbors like India and Vietnam. But whether a company's supply chain changed really depended on whether it could. Companies like Nike complained that you can't just up and move a sneaker factory at a moment's notice. One place most of those shifting supply chains did not shift to was the United States. Many of those low-skilled manufacturing jobs just are not coming back. Now, whether these shifts I just described are going to be long-term, who knows?
Who knows, indeed. Kimberly Adams with all the answers. One more question coming up in a bit. Coming up.
It could spiral out of control.
Ah, the joys of economic policy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 90 points today, 0.3%, 29,030. That is a record closing high. The NASDAQ up 7 points, less than 0.1%, 92.58. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, almost 0.2%, finished at 32.89, also a record close. To the marketplace numbers time machine we go, back to June the 15th. It was a Friday, 2018, the day when the White House announced the first round of tariffs in this trade war. Since then, all right, what do you think, huh? Since then, the Dow has added how much? 16%. The NASDAQ banked almost 20%. The S&P 500 up 18% the past year and a half. Bad day for Target, as we heard from Megan. Shares in the retailer down 6.5%. Lowe's down 0.4%. Walmart gave up 0.7%. Bonds rose, though. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.78%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Ground package delivery is where we go next. With the holidays behind us, Amazon says it's going to start letting third-party retailers on its site use FedEx again. But the story here isn't so much the specifics of that news as it is the challenges that retailers face in the last mile, getting packages to our actual doors and getting them there faster than the other guy. The World Economic Forum says that delivery dilemma is only going to get harder and more crowded. It's guessing there will be 36% more delivery vehicles out there over the next decade, with commensurate bumps in congestion, commute times, and carbon emissions. Marketplace's Jack Stewart's on that one.
Every time we click buy, a chain of events is set into motion, often involving a distant warehouse, maybe a plane, definitely a truck or two.
Got a total of 130 stops with 120 packages, or 220 packages.
The vlogger who goes by Lunatics documented a day in his life as a FedEx ground driver on his YouTube channel. It involves a lot of truck engines starting and stopping. A World Economic Forum report estimates there'll be over a third more delivery vehicles on the roads by 2030 to deliver 78% more packages, which means more emissions and more double parking. And a lot of that is hidden to us as consumers. Denise Dalhoff at the Conference Board.
The awareness is probably not that high yet, although people that live in cities certainly have noticed, like, more traffic, more, you know, parked vehicles.
And it's only going to get worse.
If we already feel the difference in the last couple of years, imagine almost 80% growth in the next 10 years. That's a number that was very alarming to us.
That's Richa Sahai, one of the authors of the report, who says congestion will definitely increase.
Which would also lead to 11 minutes increase in your time in your daily commute.
And an extra 6 million tons of CO2 emissions. And Goodchild at the University of Washington says there are ways that deliveries could be greener.
A delivery vehicle can consolidate, like a bus, you know, many packages or many orders of groceries into one vehicle.
But for that to work, we might have to give up our two-day delivery habit. The World Economic Forum also suggests nighttime deliveries, a switch to electric trucks, and the use of parcel lockers in central locations. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Today, from the Sometimes the Economy is a Tad Confusing desk, housing. We have done a fair amount of reporting about the affordable housing crisis on this program. And as we have also been reporting, job growth has slowed over the past year or so. Those two things are connected, according to a report out today from the National Association of Realtors. In some of the hottest housing markets in the country, soaring home prices go hand in hand with declining job growth. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman took that one on.
Low supply and high demand have been driving home prices higher. People's incomes haven't kept up. And in some hot metro areas where the economy's been booming, home affordability has tanked over the past 5 years, says economist Lawrence Yoon at the National Association of Realtors. His report finds there's also been
a slowdown in job growth in places like Boise, Tampa, or Salt Lake City due to affordability challenges.
This connection between lack of affordability and lack of job growth rings true to economist Robert Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders.
Those areas that expect job creation to continue have to provide housing supply because businesses, they're not going to locate jobs in a particular market if it's too expensive for the prospective workers to live there.
That's already happening in California cities from San Diego to the Bay Area, says USC economist Gary Painter.
Newly graduated college graduates and so forth who are looking to work in growing sectors are actually making decisions now to live elsewhere.
Meanwhile, older people who own their homes can't afford to move out to make room for new buyers. Tony Liebert is 56 and lives in Madison, Wisconsin. He's a commercial electrician and bought his house in the 1990s for just under $100,000.
The price now is assessed near $300,000. There's no way I can get back into it for anything like that. If I sold now, My wife and I have laughed and said, you know, we can move to Nepal and live really well.
According to the National Association of Realtors, cities where home affordability and job growth are down the most include Louisville, Atlanta, Raleigh-Durham, and Las Vegas. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's recap, shall we? President Trump and the Chinese signed that Phase 1 trade deal this morning. NAFTA is all patched up and replaced, almost, with the USMCA making its way through the Senate. We've got a new deal with Japan, too, so trade disputes all done, right? Everything set? Yeah, not quite. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor has that one.
There are plenty of other fights brewing, especially between the U.S. and Europe.
With the European Union, little progress has been made, and if anything, trade irritants are building up.
Wendy Cutler is vice president of the Asia Society Policy Institute and former acting deputy U.S. trade representative. For starters, the U.S. and Europe are still fighting over jets. The World Trade Organization ruled in favor of the U.S. and said Europe was improperly subsidizing Airbus. The U.S. imposed tariffs and is threatening more, but guess what? The U.S. is guilty too.
The Europeans are expecting a ruling from the WTO as well that will entitle them to retaliate against the United States for subsidies to Boeing.
Dan Eikenson is director of the Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Yep, it turns out the U.S. has been improperly subsidizing Boeing, so Europe's probably going to retaliate.
Depending on how the Europeans respond, it could spiral out of control.
Jets, though, are just the beginning.
There's a long list of issues that need to be resolved.
Again, Wendy Cutler.
President Trump is not happy with the imbalance in the automotive sector, in particular the fact that Europe has a 10% tariff and we only have a 2.5% tariff for autos.
And maybe the most red-hot issue right now is the fact that France and Italy are imposing taxes on U.S. tech companies like Google and Facebook, even though those companies aren't based in those countries. The rationale is they're making money off of European users. Here's President Trump a few months ago.
I'm not happy about the fact that they are taxing our companies. I'm not a fan of those companies, but if anybody's going to tax those companies, it should be the USA. It shouldn't be France and the European Union.
Gary Huffbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. He says any of these conflicts with Europe, and these are not even close to being all of them, any of them could escalate.
Because the Europeans will not be pushed around by the U.S.
He says Europe has a lot more leverage than, say, Mexico or Canada.
So that's a tinderbox. That's made for a flare-up.
There may be an incentive to keep things calm before the election. Unless, well, there isn't. Eric Altbach is Senior Vice President at the Albright-Stonebridge Group.
This is all sort of dependent on what the president, how he perceives the sort of escalation and tension with the EU, whether that will be of political benefit to him.
On the one hand, there's a political cost to tariffs that hurt some U.S. businesses. But on the other, it could be a good look to stand up to unfair treatment, as the president puts it.
I should probably mention the fact that the WTO is melting down.
The U.S. has basically shut down the World Trade Organization's highest court of appeals, meaning no decisions can be effectively appealed or finalized. That puts the U.S. at odds with much of the rest of the world. So all this is to say that 2020 is as much of a trade minefield as 2019 was. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
We've looked at the winners of the trade war, what it's done to global supply chains. Now, a question that takes a look back.
Hi, I'm Catherine Kina from Savannah, Georgia. Is there any historical precedent for tariffs really working as intended? Thanks. Bye.
Well, the short answer is it depends on what you mean by intended. Here's Kimberly with the longer answer.
Most historians and economists say trade wars and tariffs don't really help the economy. The example most folks like to point to is the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930, which was supposed to help the U.S. out of the Great Depression. It raised tariffs on hundreds of imported goods, but that sparked counter-tariffs, which kind of shut down global trade for a few years. Today, countries do still have tariffs to protect industries for security reasons. For example, even if you can get cheap steel from China, you don't really want to let them flood the market and put domestic steel out of business. Because then, if China gets mad at us and decides to stop selling us steel, that can be a problem.
We are not done by a long shot taking your questions. Let us know what you want to know about the trade war, which, just for the record, is still going on. You can do that at marketplace.org, or you can get us on Twitter. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, KairyssDal. This final note on the way out today, which you'd think you wouldn't have to say, but I guess you do. As you might have heard, the former CEO of Renault and Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, had himself smuggled out of Japan over the holidays, in part by hiding himself in a traveling case for musical equipment. That, in turn, has prompted this warning from Yamaha, maker of instruments and their cases, quote, "We won't mention the reason, but there have been many tweets about climbing inside large musical instrument cases. A warning after any unfortunate accident would be too late, so we ask everyone not to try it." All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 90 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ up 7 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, almost 0.2% there. A couple of record highs in the batch. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.